Greetings and welcome to episode one of a new podcast launched by myself, Sam Freeman. I'm currently the host of two other podcasts where I talk to people in the audio world and the music business, respectively. The first one is called Speak Hurts, and the second one is called The Record Business. This will be my third podcast production, which focuses on a very specific aspect of the music industry, namely the behavior and questionable business practices of those in power and those whom they victimize, from which I derive the name of the show, Music is a Racket. As the title suggests, I'll be examining the prevalence of unscrupulous conduct and the intentional difficulties that are forced upon not just artists, but anyone who doesn't occupy the upper ranks of the industry. There have always been those who exploit the endless supply of idealists and artists in this business, and it's almost considered a rite of passage for anyone striving for a music career to be taken advantage of, whether financially or otherwise. Having experienced my fair share of this, I've decided to finally start a podcast to cover these widespread cases of antagonisms that this industry takes the liberty and, in my opinion, the pleasure to foist on anyone not privileged enough to afford a good lawyer or have powerful friends to protect them. My first guest on the podcast is someone I already interviewed for the Speakers podcast. Jeff Bass is the musician behind much of Eminem's music from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. Him and his brother Mark are a production duo known as the Bass Brothers, and together they shared much of the production duties on Eminem's early albums. And though they made a substantial contribution to the catalog of the best-selling rapper of all time, the experience wasn't without its difficulties, whether with Eminem himself or his record label Interscope/Aftermath. Having already talked with Jeff about his work as a producer, we covered some of his other experiences in the business and how he navigated some of the difficult ones. For those of you who have already listened to the Speak Hurts interview, the first 5 minutes of this recording are pretty much the same, just to let people get acquainted with Jeff's background, and thereafter we dive into some other topics. So I hope you enjoy this conversation, and thanks again for listening. All right, I thought we'd start off with some kind of career retrospective stuff. I believe from the age of 16 to 19-ish, you and your brother Mark were in a band called Dream Boy that got a record deal with Quest Records.
Correct. I had been playing with these fellas from back in high school, from the time we were 14. And this was the summer of graduated in 79. And I moved to California. And I got a phone call from a couple of the members of the band saying that they had these managers and but they want to audition everybody. So I'm like, I wasn't going to go, but I ended up going back to Detroit and auditioned, and I got the part, obviously. A month later, we got a record deal with Quincy based on a demo that we had cut. And that contract, that was good for about two albums. I think the deal lasted from 1980 to 1985. That's how long we were with Q. And we had not great success. We had a couple of songs that charted. But it was fun. And, you know, we were young and we didn't really know what we were doing. We just were so happy that we were able to get this record deal and share some of what we did with the world. And 85, we broke up. It just wasn't happening. So
I see. Is it true that Michael Jackson heard the demo and kind of vouched for you or co-signed you or something like this?
That's exactly right. That's right. He was, I forgot which album, Bad maybe. They got the cassette tape the day he was in the studio with Quincy. So he was like in awe that we were from Detroit because he, you know, his Motown days were Detroit. He liked it. And Quincy right away signed us, and yeah, the rest is history. I mean, it just, it wasn't a huge success, but it wasn't bad. We were able to tour a little bit and play parties. We went there, played birthday parties for Quincy, and got to play with Shalimar and a bunch of other people, so that was fun. It's a kind of intro into the music business.
But I mean, what were his expectations of you? I mean, commercially or otherwise, did he just sort of lose interest, or did he just not want to put the money behind it, or was the music not good enough?
Probably a combination, but I think what also happened was in 1984-5, Quest signed a group called New Order and was changing their direction a little bit. They didn't want a little R&B group. They just kind of lost interest, I think, what was happening. I think if it would have blown up, like how Ready for the World blew up, because they came out actually after us, but their label really pushed for them. So that's kind of what happened. Was not a success, but we don't look at it as a failure. We just, it was, you know, 4 years out of our life that was, you learn from it. And for me, I learned that writing and producing will be the thing, which that after that 85, that's all I concentrated on was writing and producing.
Is it true that you and Mark were kind of broke by the end of it?
Oh, yeah. By the end of Dream Boy? No, we had not one penny, and we were not able to, like, have a real studio. So we had a makeshift studio in my mother's basement. And that's where we started honing the skills of writing and producing. And that's where we started bringing all kinds of people, like, even in the techno world, these guys that are huge now started off in my basement. Juan Atkins, all these guys from the Detroit scene.
And in terms of you discovering Eminem, the story goes that Mark heard him on the radio. He called in and asked to be put in touch with him. Was he around 15 when you first met him?
1994. He just turned 21, living with his then girlfriend, Kim, who he ended up marrying and divorcing.
He was flipping burgers at the time?
Oh, yeah. Flipping burgers in Detroit. I forgot the name of the place. Gilbert's was the name of the burger joint. Yeah, that's when we met him. He was on open mic night at one of the radio stations, and my brother heard him. Called the radio station to see if he can get a number. Called the number. Eminem answered the phone. My brother invited him to the studio, which was on 8 Mile Road. And he came. He came with D12, but we didn't know that was D12 at the time. And my brother was blown away. I didn't understand what he was saying. He was rapping way too fast. But we decided to take him in and groom him. So that's what we did.
I'm not entirely sure about this part, but is it true that he at one point wanted you to take him to Elektra because you had a previous relationship with them to get him a deal?
That probably came up in the conversations because we had to deal with Tyson Woody first. And then we also offered it to Westbound. Before we went out to the Rap Olympics out in L.A. in 98, we took our little CD and took it over to Westbound, but he wasn't interested. Which today he like regrets that he, you know, didn't take it on. But nobody was interested until Jimmy got the package on a weekend, played it, fell in love with it, called Dre, said, "You got to hear this, white boy." And gold ever, you know, just like immediately.
And the guy running Westbound, was that Armin Baladian?
Armin Baladian, yep. He's about 89 now, but still active.
After Infinite didn't go as expected, perhaps, what prompted you to make the Slim Shady LP as opposed to just giving up or calling it quits?
By that time, we really believed in him as an artist. And we just, you know, the thought of just quitting wasn't there yet. After we finished everything we were going to do with him, right before the Rap Olympics, we said, this is all we could do. You know, we're not capable of doing, we've done our best and thought we created something that was new. And he gave it his all and got the lucky break in L.A. Thank God to Evan Bogart. I know the record usually shows that Dean Geislinger was the responsible person that took care of it. Not true. It was Evan Bogart. You know who Evan Bogart is, right?
No, of course. I was going to ask about this because it's very interesting how they keep scrubbing his name everywhere. When you see it on Wikipedia, it's usually not true.
Also, Jimmy, Dre, and M and Paul Rosenberg made sure that during that HBO, The Defiant Ones, they skipped over the whole story of the Bass Brothers and what really went down. Why? We don't even know. But they did. And so that story they made up about Dean Geislinger. He was hired later after M already had the deal. We brought him in and gave him his job. They acted like they were giving him the job. But that's how the story went. So it was really Evan Bogart.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask this question at the very end of the interview, but I'll just ask it now because it's kind of tied to what you're saying. When you look at Marshall's interviews over the years, especially from like mid-2000s onwards, he doesn't really mention the Bass Brothers.
Right.
And I remember reading of something a few years back where he would talk about the early days, but he wouldn't mention your name. He'd be like, oh, the producers I used to work with, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then I watched the Defiant Ones and I don't see any mention of you guys. And it's almost become like this very neat, convenient way or story to just present Dre as the one who discovered him and Jimmy as the savvy executive. And you guys are scrubbed from the story. And I'm wondering, why do you think that the industry wants to tell that story and why does Marshall go along with it?
It's a very good question, because I mean, we were responsible clearly for a majority of album one through four, more than Dre did. But the world knows it as Dre because we originally needed Dre for his market, his demographics, and we agreed that he would get the he would do the singles and he would be able to whatever the narrative became, but we figured after it got out and it got famous and popular that the Bass Brothers production would come out too, and only real fans around the world know that. Still, unto this day, I take a hit song like "Without Me." Dre gets the credit for it. Dre didn't never even worked on that record. And also 90% of what we did was all live music. So I think that they didn't know how to market us. And just because we were the writers, the producers, the publishers, I don't think they liked that too much because we had a piece of everything. Our production company, FBT Productions, 8 Mile Style Publishing. But that's business. Because the paperwork shows the truth. They really went out of their way to make us a smaller part of. I've heard Em in several interviews talk about how he had this guitar player that would just play on his records. Well, I think I was a little more than just a guitar player because, you take the song Beautiful that came out in, 2009? There's not one instrument on there that I didn't play. It was all me, nobody else. And that was the same thing with every hit record that I wrote for him, but I never got my flowers for any of that, which is fine. I mean, it's just that. And when people like yourself ask why that was, why didn't they ever really talk about you guys? It's a question I'd like to know, to be honest with you, because it makes no sense.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I think that the dynamic between Marshall and you and your brother is one of the more peculiar artist/producer relationships. I actually put it on par with Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson in terms of how much success the two of you could have together, only for one of them to basically just ignore the other once the relationship ends or not really give the full credit.
It's very strange. I know that my narrative always for 30 years is I couldn't do any of this without M. If M didn't get on my tracks, I don't think they would have been as popular as they became. And so I give him his flowers, and I just speak the truth. For me, there's no reason to sugarcoat anything because I know what I did. I know the life I was living, writing all this music and recording all this music, and he knows too, because it was just him and I in the studio. It's not like there was a whole posse. There was never a posse, ever. It was business all the time, 20 hours a day studio time. And the only time there was more people is if I was recording a D12 album, which, same thing. You never hear them talk about me? No, but I'm the one who wrote and produced the whole first album. But, and actually Jake, my son, had just asked Swifty and Vaughn from D12. Why didn't you use my father on the second album? And they went, we don't know. He says, what do you mean you don't know? I mean, it's your album. He goes, nah, that was Em and Paul saying, nope, you ain't using them. Which is sad. I'm not saying that D12 World would have sold more because I wrote on it. It's just mind-boggling how you know, we had such success with the first album. I had a number one record that I wrote the music to with D12, which was my first number one record, even before Eminem. Purple Pills became a number one song, and that was before. So it's just interesting how they kind of cornered themselves, you know, and left us out.
I do wonder, because when you say that certain decisions came from M and Paul, it does seem like these things come from somewhere up above, like the D12 guys might not necessarily have a clue, or Eminem even seems like at some point he's being told what to do. And I do wonder if what...
Yeah, like a puppet.
Yeah.
You got Dre, who's very powerful. You know, I mean, he actually called me up before and was like, when we were doing the Slim Shady LP, very first album, and he called me up because I was like, all right, this is going to be cool. Why don't we get in the studio and collaborate and see what we can come up with it? Not one time. And he called me up once to tell me that this is a friendly competition. I'm like, what do you talk about? The kids that we're the same. We're splitting the album, but we really didn't split the album. He did three songs. We did the rest. But the point is that we had one common goal, was to make Eminem some great music. I was never in competition with Dre. Could you be? Look what he already had done. You know, I'm just like, nah, this is cool. We should all just, you know, me, Mike Elizondo, Scott Storch, Dre, Steve King, and M. If we would have gotten together and it was all separate. Always separate. I don't understand it. And here we are all these years later, and I wish I had a better answer, but I don't.
Did you ever have issues with Jimmy or sense anything antagonistic from Interscope?
We were really close for the first two albums. And then what I think happened is, it's not that he lost interest. It's that it became more of the business than the music and the relationship that we were developing. And also, fast forward a little bit, we had a lawsuit, a Universal lawsuit, and he didn't like that shit. But they were ripping us off. So what do you do? We're not just going to lay down and die. So our little company fought back. And that was a big lawsuit, 7.5 years. But I think that that's what ended a lot of the relationships, is because we didn't just let them walk all over us. We knew we owned the masters. We knew the difference between a digital sale and a digital download. So we fought everybody that would try to take from us. But then, you know, what does that look like? It looks like, oh, there's FBT Productions. They're like not doing the work anymore, but they're suing. But that was not the case. It was about fair business. But you can get yourself in trouble just because your actions, you know. But we did it for the principle that we wanted our ownership. That's it. And if Eminem and Paul and Jimmy and whoever else didn't want to deal with us, so be it. It's sad. But, you know, I think that also didn't help the cause.
Last thing about this. I've always found that Paul Rosenberg is a very strange figure because he doesn't really have any other artists of note. He clearly looks like Eminem's handler, or like somebody just put him there and said, you just manage this for the next 20 years and don't do nothing else. And don't show your face, don't do any interviews, don't have a personality, just be the handler guy in the background. He's very strange.
Yeah. So we gave him his job. He was an attorney out of New York and from Michigan, and he was a hip hop head. And we needed an attorney that had the legal right to negotiate contracts in California, New York, and who better than Paul Rosenberg? So we actually hired him first. And then after he was a lawyer, he did the contract, the very first Aftermath contract. After that, he decided that, fuck being a lawyer, I'll manage the kid. And that's what he did. He just started managing him. And then over the years, M was so successful, Paul was able to wiggle his way into, you know, calling himself executive producer and, you know, getting on the movie and all this stuff. And then becoming, what, Def Jam's president? And he had zero success. Shady Records, zero success other than 50. So he can't, he knows nothing. He basically is a handler. He follows the same narrative as Jimmy, Dre, and M.
Very strange world the music business can be.
Yeah, and Jimmy once, I said something to Jimmy before. I said to him, I'm like, what's up? I mean, I just wrote and produced a 10 million seller album. And the kid goes up to, you know, he's got 15 Grammys. You ever hear my name on the Grammy Awards? He thanks everybody else, but you don't hear Jeff Bass or Mark Bass or FBT. You know, it's strange. And so I went to Jimmy. I'm like, this sucks, dude. He goes, it's what it is. I produced Bruce Springsteen and Stevie Nicks and U2, and they didn't thank me. I'm like, but that's not okay. He goes, yes, it is. You're going to get house money. And I'm like, what the fuck is house money? I don't do house music. And he goes, no, money to buy a house. Oh, okay. Great. That's how he said, don't take it personal. I don't know. How do you not take it personal? You just heard this kid win. You're sitting there in the audience with your family. And, you know, part of the accolade is you want your family to hear, you know, ooh, my son, right? Or whatever, my uncle, my father. And never fucking heard it. You know, and I accepted it. And I was like, yeah, hey. I would say something to Emmy. But, oh, I'm sorry, bro. There's so much going on and this and that. I'm like, that's cool. Because, you know, I had to think about it as like, all right, well, I wrote it. I own it. Whatever. So you didn't say my name. It's all right.
It's becoming an increasingly popular conspiracy theory, of course, that the reason Eminem is so, like, the way that he is in an unexpected way, like, not even his behavioral patterns and even the way his face looks sometimes, it's like, why did his eyes become so bug-eyed around 2008 or 9? Or, like, why did he stop rapping the way that he did, and he changed his flow, and now he doesn't even sound like his old self? And the conspiracy theory is that it's not him, that it's a clone, or that he passed away and they replaced him.
Yeah, no. So to be, I'll be 100% honest with you. Eminem and myself became, well, my brother, we all were big drug addicts. And the very last, I think I had recorded back in 2006, 30 some odd songs with them, higher than shit. And the only song that had made it onto an album was Beautiful. We were stoned out of our minds. But some reason he liked that one song, because we all became clean after, well, 2010, everybody got clean. Beautiful was the last song, which is one of the reasons why after that period, after 2010, nothing sounded like Eminem. He changed everything. I'm not saying it's for the worst. I just say it changed. You are absolutely right. And people do notice that. But he's not a clone. He's just a 51-year-old man that, you know, he'll probably explain it as growing up. It's funny because one of the other songs that didn't make the albums is a song called Jewelry, which is amazing. But he talks about it, and he starts rapping, and he goes, everybody wants him to rap like this, like when he rapped like this. So he changed that. Maybe. But, you know how Slim Shady is Marshall is him. And each album reflected persona. Now, you fast forward to after Encore. So you had the Marshall Mathers LP 2, the album after the greatest hits, right? Not good. And for me, it just kept getting not good. Occasionally, something would come out like Rap God or whatever. But that was like a... It was almost a gimmick, but even then he didn't rap like Eminem per se. Yeah, I think that he that chapter of the Slim Shady, the alter ego, and the Eminem, that the story, which would have been really cool if he would have continued it that way, because he's so good at becoming Slim Shady, and he was so good at being Eminem. But I think the people around him, knowing the way Eminem thinks, I think they changed his mind about doing something different. That's my opinion. I don't know, but I know when I hear Slim Shady, or when I go back to Infinite, Slim Shady EP, LP, Marshall Mathers, Eminem Show, Curtain Call, I can see it go like this. And like right now, there's a big hype about him dropping another album. They're freaking out because he released these cartoons. Did you see those? He made cartoons of Slim Shady LP, it starts off with me doing the public service announcement, and we're both cartoon characters. It's hilarious. Then he released Zoe, which was a skit on the LP. Then he released a Paul skit. But everybody, all the fans were like, he's coming out with Slim Shady LP 2. No, he's not. He's coming out with an album, but that's not it. I don't know what's going to be. I know that my kids are 34 and 21 now, other than Jake, because Jake is just a hip-hop head. Nobody cares anymore. I mean, the kids of today, they know of Eminem just because they see him. But his music, a lot of them don't know what his music is. They were way too young when he was in his prime. So, I mean, the boy still has monthly listeners, which is, thank God. So he's still relevant all over the world. But I believe that if he would just do one more album, which I had mentioned 4 years ago, to do the Slim Shady LP with exactly the same people that did your first Slim Shady LP, it would be the biggest album he ever recorded. Especially sonically, it would sound just like the first album. Because it should just be us doing what we do. You know, we're not, you know, it's not going to be a bunch of trap beats and drill beats. Like Eminem fans, they don't want to hear that. They want to hear Brain Damage. They want to hear him get stupid on something. And that's just my opinion, I guess. You know, it's just like, he can do whatever he wants to. He's the star. You know, I can always, as a writer, producer, I can do it, but it doesn't matter. It's very rare, anyways, for one writer, producer to stay with the artist the whole career. I mean, Drake uses Shabib 40 all the time. They got it right, because the songs that Shabib does for him, it's still in the line of what he was doing for him. He's not, he came out 2010 till now. He hasn't changed much, really, when you think about it. I mean, his style is his style. M went from like so many different styles, you know, and I think that fans really would like to hear what they first heard. He was the voice of, everybody had thoughts of what he was saying, but he said he did it.
So I've heard you mention before that when you go into, or maybe in the past years ago, when you would go into label offices to play new music or introduce new artists that you were working with, the executive would just say, do you have another Eminem or something similar?
Yeah, that was a big issue for me back in the day, because I would develop and work on other artists, and I would take those artists to the labels, because at that time, 2007 and 2008 and 2009, I was able to go anywhere and get in, you know, without really just a phone call, I'm coming in. And so they would love the music. And they said, well, we hate the rapper. We need another Eminem. You know, this was from Warner Brothers. This was from Sony. And I said, there's only one Eminem, you know, and it's already been done. And so they were like, no, when you have somebody in that category, then we can sit down and talk. This was before the internet thing happened. You know, now it's like they don't really care what you bring them. If you have to have enough following to pretty much do it on your own. And when you could get as popular as you can, to at least fill up a venue like the House of Blues, which is like, 3,000 people, then we'll talk. You know, it's a whole different game now.
So, I mean, are you at the point where you no longer try to shop artists or try to get major label interest? Or
no, I have one artist that I'm working with in the hip-hop world. It's like hip-hop rock world. And we're just going to independently do a release. We're not going to go to a label. Because it's that, I think those days, for me anyways, those are over. I mean, I might go to a label for distribution, but not to get in bed with, you know, to do any kind of a record deal where they commit to X amount of debt, like it used to be. The whole industry's changed. Like, a lot of the dudes out right now, besides your bigger name acts, the new deals are mainly 360 deals where they share the cost with the artist. But the idea today is to do it independently, because why should you give away all your money? Because it's a whole different it's different when you're selling physical items. It's very different. You know, with streaming, it's just the platforms don't pay you shit, and that's a problem. So, I mean, you can have, you know, three million streams in your, that you, doesn't equate to money. You know, you got to have billions of streams to equate to money, and it's hard to do that.
So I wonder, like, with the resume that you have, having worked with the best-selling rapper of all time and essentially, you know, made his career on the music end, are you at a point now where, because of the change in the industry, and because also it's been a long time, like 25 years, that the stuff that you could do in the late 2000s, as far as getting into any office and basically people know your name because of what you've done, does that still carry weight? Like, are you able to use your name to do anything in the industry anymore?
Not so much. I mean, I could still talk to some radio people, you know, that know the backstory. But, you know, for the most part, no, it doesn't really equate to more work, which I always used to think would. Like, I used to think that when I made it in the business, oh, now I could be, like, all over the place. And I suppose if I would have pushed that issue more, then it could have happened. But I think for me, I finished with that world, especially the hip-hop world. I would have loved to have gone into, like, the pop end of this genre. Like Mike Elizondo, who did a lot of the early Dre stuff for M. I mean, he's on top of the world. He does everything. So he set himself up that way. And we could have done that, but we didn't. It was a lot to just deal with the responsibility of doing the Eminem stuff, plus I did the D12 stuff. So it was a lot for one person to run around to studios and writing and doing all this stuff. And I loved it, but I just did. Scott Storch was, you know, he started off as playing keyboards for Dre, then became a producer, and then he was like on everybody's record, which is amazing, but he paid the price too. It's a lot of work and a lot of craziness you go through with that. There's an upside to becoming a world-renowned record producer, and you almost feel like you're being whored out, you know, and God bless them for having that kind of success, but I was good. I was good because I knew I had several Eminem hit singles, so I knew that the income, as far as money-wise, that set me up pretty good, you know. Then it became, I mean, I never did it for the money in the first place, but later in the career, it seemed to be that's all everybody was talking about was with the money part of it. And I think that was one of the main reasons we did succeed, is because we didn't know about money. We loved music, and we loved hip hop and pop and R&B and everything. And we just did it because that's what we do. So as the years went by, I realized that, okay, that was fun. You know, part of the journey, that was cool. But my true love my entire life was smooth jazz and R&B. And I never really could do it because, you know, being in the studio 20 hours a day doing hip hop, I didn't really have the chance. And when I did have the chance, free time in the studio, I would do that, except I didn't release anything. So it was really like writing these smooth jazz records and for myself, so I could sit back and listen to them. But, you know, here, you know, fast forward to today, I've got a couple of projects that I'm doing that are in the smooth jazz genre. And it's a lot of fun. So it's music is going to be coming fun to me again, because I'm not doing it for, you know, people in that world, the smooth jazz world. You don't sell a lot of records. You sell enough records to where you can go and perform, you know, but the days of like the big money making, million selling jazz, smooth jazz albums, I don't think that's happening anymore. Plus the geographics, you know, the 30, 40, 50, and 60 and 70 year olds going to listen to my music, which is fine, because that's where I'm in that category now. I'm not a kid anymore. So that's where my true love is.
All right. And if an artist wants to sort of hire you as a producer or to work on their record, how much is that going to cost them these days?
First of all, I never did anything for a fee. Like a lot of guys do it. Even Dre does it. You know, you got to give him $250,000 to do one song, you know. So, but I never do that. I the things that I have done in the past is where I take it at the on the back end. You know, I'll do the job, and then, you know, if it sells, this is my percentage and this is your percentage. But I guess if someone threw me the money and said, hey, I'll give you, you know, $250,000 to do a record, yeah, I might do that. But only because I'm older now and it's just like, oh, okay. But that never has been my motivation. I've always just, if it made it, great. And also what I did do a lot was I'd come in with music 90% of the time first before M got put lyrics on it. And we just split 50-50. Just makes it life a lot easier. If it did blow up, he's not making more money, I'm not making more money. You know, so if someone came to me and it was the right thing, sure, I'd probably do something with a new artist. Except the new artists today, it's not my genre. You know, they even my own son, who's 21, my youngest son, like he listens to my stuff that I have written and the stuff that I still write hip hop tracks and stuff like that. But it's just I just do it to keep fresh. He's not a fan. You know, he's like, nah, Dad, you got to use Fruity Loops and you got to do it like this. You know, it's all point and click. And I'm like, no. That's great. But I don't do that. I play live instrument from A to Z, and then I put it together. And so he goes, that's so much work. And they're like, he's into, yeah, I wrote 10 beats in about 45 minutes. I'm like, now what do you do with them? Like, I got this beautiful studios in Detroit, and people actually come into the studio to rent studio time. And they don't even use any of the equipment. They use two channels on my mixing board, which is like a 96-channel mixing board. And they come in and they rent the speakers, basically. And they put their music through two channels. And then they sit in the control room with headphones on and do their vocal. And they sing through auto-tune. So right away, you know, they're getting their shit in key. And it's like, I don't want to do that. And I'm trying to teach my youngest son to do things the old-fashioned way. You know, and I'm having a hard time convincing him.
What will you be doing for the rest of the year musically? You said you had some projects with some artists, but, like, what's the thrust of what you do now? Are you sort of semi-retired?
Well, semi-retired. I'm putting together this father and son smooth jazz project that me and Jake are going to release. Really good record. And then actually, there's 4 Eminem interpolations on the record, smooth jazz though, which is very strange, but chord progressions follow exact. I do a version of Kim, but in smooth jazz style, kind of smooth jazz Latin. And you'll know it's Kim because the piano line is the same. And then I do Cleaning Out My Closet. I do Bad Meets Evil. And I did Bad Meets Evil with Bob James and Dave McMurray, horn player. I also used Mindy Abir. She's a saxophone player. I used her. So I got some really good players on the project. And then all drums and percussion were Jacob. He did everything. And I did all keys. And Jake also did string arrangements. And I did everything else, guitars, bass, piano, synth. It's a really cool sounding record, though, but the versions of the Eminem songs are special because to be able to take a song like Kim and turn it into smooth jazz, it's like ridiculous. It's just really good. And this has been in the making for 10 years, by the way. So we're finally getting to it after all this time. It's going to be fun because I don't recall ever hearing a father-son smooth jazz duo. Never really heard of that. So we're going to come out with that. And hopefully people will enjoy it.
No, I hope that goes well.